Yes, so I've been given the dubious honor of being the first speaker, right? So we're here to discuss sort of theoretical physics and machine learning, right? And so theoretical physics is a pretty old subject, and machine learning is a pretty new subject. So I'm representing the old part, right? Because very unusually, we're going to see that many of the speakers are quite a bit younger than me, let's say, right? Much younger and more diverse than you normally see at a theoretical physics meeting. Now, do not worry, right? I only have 120 pages of slides, and there's no more than 3 equations per slide. And there will be a pop quiz, by the way, at the end. You do that to your students. See how much you enjoy it. Okay, so here we are at this KITP, right? So this is the Institute for Theoretical Physics, and to represent that, right? Nothing happens. So much for, machines. Let's see. Now even less happens. Magic. That's back. And now the screen is gone. Sometimes this guy is loose, but it should. Yeah, see, there we are. But it's still not progressing. Okay, not to worry, there's buttons. There, the power was on. Yeah, it's one of those little tricks, right? You got to turn the power on in order to. Okay, so here's a picture of theoretical physics, right? So this is what theoretical physicists do, and you can even see on this blackboard here, right? This was from yesterday's talks, I think. And when we go outside for the coffee breaks and things like that, you'll see that this is a beautiful building, and this is the world's premier institute for theoretical physics. This was created about 40 years ago or so, and it's been mimicked all over the world now, but this is still, I would say, the number one spot for theoretical physics. And it's been led by a very distinguished line of theoretical physicists, of which Lars is the most recent. And just this year, Lars was elected to the National Academy of Sciences, which is a very high honor, and he's a very quiet guy, but he's a very distinguished quiet guy, right? Unlike me. So this is what we think of when we do theoretical physics. Now it's working. Now, for the last roughly 50 or 60 years, we've had a subject called computational physics. So around the time of the Manhattan Project and so forth, people began to realize that just driving the equations of physics was still important, but you also needed to solve them, and you needed to solve them sufficiently accurately for the problem at hand. And they started using computers, and in particular, Nick Metropoulos and Feynman and Teller at Los Alamos used that when they were developing the nuclear weapons. And so here's a picture I picked at random from plasma physics. And you know, the details don't matter, but what it is you use the latest computers that are available. And at certain times in the past, it has been physics applications and other science applications that have driven the development of our modern computers. And things like the internet began as DARPANET and things like that. Okay. So then we also have quantum mechanics, right? And this starts about 1900. Max Planck first introduces something called Planck's constant, and it's the first sign that there's something seriously wrong with classical physics. So for classical physics here, we'll think of Newton Newton's laws. How many people have tried, at least, to teach Newton to their students? Raise your hand high, because I can get a good sense of it. Okay, good. But you know, all that sort of comes apart, and so these nice illustrations, right? Well, what you can see clearly here from the 20s and 30s that hairstyle was a bit of an issue, right? Well, we have famous people like, and especially Schrodinger, right? The Schrodinger equation is the equation which, if you solve it, tells you the rules of quantum mechanics for many, many systems. So this is a nice book that you can get for about 10 bucks, but it's fun to, you know, it's a sort of graphic novel of the start of quantum mechanics. And then we discovered that, so actually, if you go to sort of regular physics, I mean, if you look at the 20th century, there were many advances in theoretical physics in the 20th century, but I would claim that the most useful one was quantum mechanics by far. So there's lots of extremely intellectually fascinating improvements in all sorts of things, especially astrophysics and cosmology and so forth. But the most useful one was quantum mechanics. And as I'm going to explain, the reason that quantum mechanics was so useful is because it allowed you to understand chemistry and materials. So as a practical matter, this has had an enormous impact. And it was only that he happened to be around, Linus Pauling was around at the start of quantum mechanics, and then he wrote these very famous papers that became the theory of the chemical bond. And all of our sort of knowledge and understanding of chemistry is basically in the language that Linus Pauling used in 1933. Okay. So very famously, though, one of the founders of quantum mechanics was a very strange person called Paul Dirac. He was a physicist at Bristol, and there's a great book about him from a few years ago by a guy called Farmello. And he was an unusual sort of person. And he said in 1929, and Einstein credited him with sort of this one of the deepest understandings of quantum mechanics. And he says all the physical laws necessary for the mathematical theory of a lot of physics, sort of everyday physics and all of chemistry, are completely known. And the only difficulty that is that the equations are a little too hard to solve. So about 25 years ago or so, I started getting interested in this problem of how do you sort of solve the equations of chemistry on a computer in order to make predictions, right? How do you solve the Schrodinger equations? And about that time, people would quote this in this field, and this to me, it always looked like, well, this is some sort of very fancy theoretical physicist saying, well, we figured everything out important, and the rest of you out there just try to figure out how to solve those equations, but we don't care. So this is what people would say in this field, right? However, if you go and you read the original paper, you discover that the next sentence is that in fact the meaning of this is totally the opposite. He's saying, because it's too hard to solve, then we need to work on this problem to make simple approximations so that we have things that we can solve. And this is what he wanted to do. And in fact, he worked on this quite a lot. So that's physics, right? And we'll get back to that story shortly. Now let's go to machine learning. So machine learning, so you're going to hear a lot about machine learning today, I guarantee it, right? And I'm not an expert in machine learning, right? I don't know much about it. But the people who follow me are experts because they're younger, right? It only appeared about 10 years ago, I would say. A lot of the most recent things came in the last 10 years. Of course, there was lots of stuff in the past. So examples include Google's PageRank, right? So we all actually now use machine learning all the time without even knowing about it. And one of the most famous ones, the thing that got somebody may remember back, you know, there used to be like Yahoo and other sort of search engines, right? only vaguely remembered, right? What happened to them? Well, Google happened to them, right? So this was a computer scientist, and they developed this thing called PageRank, where they looked on the web, and they look at how many pages, given pages, connected to, and they use these connections to decide what's the most important way to answer your question, what are the most important websites. And this PageRank was so successful, and it basically sort of solved this problem of when you type in, how do you find throughout the entire web most relevant pages, it basically made Google, right? That's how Google sort of first became really noticed, and then it has, of course, branched all over the place. How many people know the story about AlphaGo? Okay, so I'll tell you about AlphaGo, right? So I know some of these things because I work sometimes with the people from Google. So whatever it was, 10 or 15 years ago, there was a famous match of, was it Deep Blue in the playing chess with the world chess champion, who was the Russian at the time? Kasparov, yes, exactly. And it didn't go so well for Kasparov. But for up to that time, there'd been this problem of sort of making a computer that could beat the world chess champion, right? And that sort of problem is one where the rules are well known, and you could load up the computer with lots and lots of old games by old masters, and the computer would calculate using the rules from, what the likely positions are, and would run through, millions, if not billions, of possible moves and evaluate them and decide what to do. And this computer was ultimately able to beat Kasparov. But the game of Go is a much harder game, a much more sort of open game. And so it was always thought that you couldn't really design a computer to win a game of Go. And it depends on lots of sort of human judgment. And the number of combinations is far, far greater. Well, so with machine learning, they created this thing called AlphaGo, which, the first thing that they did was they trained looking at all the old games. But the difference was, instead of trying to sort of figure out all possible moves in the future, it uses these machine learning algorithms where it sort of teaches itself what it would like. It sort of figures out, it just learns from old games, not trying to compute all the possibilities, but simply come up with the best possible answers, but not going through all options. And you'll hear about some of these algorithms later. But AlphaGo was then able to beat, I think it was the number 3 ranked Go champion in the world, and then a later version of this program beat the world's champion. Now, since then, they've created further machine learning algorithms where they now have basically something like 2 of these machines, and instead of starting them off with a list of all the human games that have ever been played, instead they have these 2 machines play against each other. You only tell them what the basic rules are and no other information. And they learn from the outcome of these games what is the best strategy. And so armed with these games that no human has ever played and playing in a totally different style, now the latest version of this can beat the one that beat the number 1 human 100 times in a row. So it is now at a point where this game, and actually we heard, I think it came out just in the last few weeks, of something called Alpha Star. Does anybody know what the game Stargate is? Raise your hand if you know what Stargate is. Ah, some people know what Stargate is, right? So now there's a thing that just came out in the last few weeks called Alpha Star. So Stargate is a very, very complex game with many moving parts, and you need a variety of strategies to win this game. And Alpha Star, I think it was unveiled this month anyway, is a neural network which can win against, I think we heard it was against any human playing this game. So what's happening in this world of games is the games are getting much more complicated, and the machine learning is able to actually do the things that humans used to be champions at, right? And we'll hear lots of examples of this. Okay. Oh, this is one. This is theoretical physics, right? But I'm afraid I've included a little biology. So this is just one I happen to know about from a friend at Google. People take pictures of the back of your eyeball, and if you have diabetes, they look at the blood vessels in the back of the eyeball, and you can spot when hemorrhages occur, and this is the sort of process by which diabetes can lead to blindness, right? And something like 400 million people in the world have gotten blindness through this process. So Google is very interested in going into health, and in this thing that came out about a year or so ago, they were showing that. So in lots of medical applications, the question is like, how do you decide when something is diseased and something is healthy? And in the past, of course, it's always been sort of very highly trained doctors, and it could be this, it could be, you know, is there a tumor in a cancer scan or anything like that? And it's a person who says, is it this or is it that, right? Now, in virtually all cases where they've trained these algorithms, the algorithms outperform now the humans. And it is a much more sort of reliable thing to give it to the computer that looks at these images and decides which ones. Now, you'll probably also see during the day lots of things where people figure out whether or not it's a cat in an image, right, which is also fun, but this is kind of more important. But the reason I bring this one up is because I'm talking to the guys involved with it, right, when they were showing this to the doctors after, so they get a whole bunch of data, right? They get these scans, and they know whether or not the person was healthy or sick, and so they use this data, and then they use that to train the machine. It's called supervised learning. You have the data, it finds the pattern. Well, in this case, of course, when they've done the study, and then they're showing it to the doctors, the doctors aren't exactly enjoying the presentation that much because you don't like to find out that this computer can do your job better than you. But in the process, my friend was telling me that they were showing them this, and a kid in the back of the room, a high school kid, says, oh, and by the way, you know, I don't know, it wasn't this picture, right? That's the picture that's from a woman. And they said, what? Like, and he said, oh, that's from a woman. And they said, well, how do you know? And the kid was a summer intern, right? And the kid's job was to type up the data and feed it into the computer. And the kid noticed that on the files, it also said whether or not the patient was male or female. So that's yes or no. So he fed that piece of data in as well as everything else. And then discovered that the computer can look at the image of the eyeball and tell, like almost perfectly, whether or not it's a man or a woman. And nobody knew that these eyeball scans give you that information. Nobody had ever thought to ask that question before. And I was a high school intern, figured that out. Okay, so back to work, right? That was our fun bit. Now back to the physics-y things, right? Molecular dynamics. So there's a huge field called molecular dynamics of modern, and it's not just physics, but it's chemistry and materials and lots of other things, right? And so when you have something like a molecule, and I brought along the simplest possible molecule. Now, this isn't a real molecule. This is a representation. Right? But this is... So these are two hydrogen. How many people here have taught chemistry as well as physics? Okay, great, fantastic. Okay, now I'm in my element, right? So this is H2, right? Yeah, so you know what that is. That's great. Okay, so the nuclei, by nuclei we just mean the centers, right, are much heavier than the electrons, okay? So things that are light tend to be more quantum mechanical. But the nuclei are heavy, and most of the time you can treat them as classical point particles, and they follow Newton's laws. Now, way back in the 30s, people started developing sort of approximate rules for the forces between atoms in a molecule. And if you have a formula for the force between the atoms, then you can feed it to the computer, and it can just solve Newton's equations for the forces between the atoms. And you can do what's called a molecular dynamics simulation. And that's just using the positions of the atoms, but not the electrons, because you can't do quantum mechanics that way. But you can nowadays do a huge simulation. So there are lots of these simulations for drug design and materials discovery use these, what we call classical simulations. But they cannot break bonds, because when you break the bonds, the electrons determine the energetics, and you need quantum mechanics to figure that out. So here's a picture from, I think, Klaus Schulten's group. But this is the kind of thing where you get a big chunk of protein or something, and you're looking at some, you know, real biological process. You can do that, and there's a whole industry of this, where people in universities and companies and everywhere do this for medicinal chemistry and drug design. And so this is going on all the time. You buy the software and you run it. And in fact, there was a Nobel Prize a few years ago in chemistry for sort of mixing quantum mechanics with this kind of thing. But the problem is you cannot break bonds. So if actual chemistry occurs, these simulations don't work, right? Which is a bit weird, right? But a lot of biophysical processes, or you know, you sort of stop the movie, do the chemistry, and start the movie again. But it's not good, right? Okay. And all you really want out of these the quantum calculation is the energy as a function of the separation of say two nuclei. Now this is the simplest bond, right? I'll show you fancier ones in a while. But if you can calculate that, so this is the energy for two electrons in a hydrogen molecule as a function of the distance. And the place where the minimum on the energy is, that's where the force is zero, and that tells you the equilibrium bond length. So if you can figure that out, you can predict what the equilibrium bond length of a molecule is. Now, people won't be that impressed, because they've known the equilibrium bond length of H2 for about 100 years or so, right? But if you can do it for a bigger molecule, one that nobody's ever really looked at before, then they're impressed. Okay, so this is a slide I made, you can tell, sometime, you know, back in the 18th century, where we still had slides and you drew things and pictures, but I scanned it. So these are all these different materials, and they only differ in many areas of science. They only differ by having different nuclei and different numbers of electrons, but nothing else, right? So we know the laws of quantum mechanics. We know that if we solve them, it will make these predictions, right? But why is it that we can't, right? And so there's I call it an evil problem, right? So you have to do quantum mechanics because it's what we call a many-body problem, right? Every electron sees every other one as well as the nucleus. It turns out the energy of these electrons is actually really, really large. Each atom has a huge amount of electronic energy, and it changes just a tiny amount when you make a chemical bond, as in like one part in 10 million or so, right? So this is problematic, because the accuracy of your calculation has to be really high. And then the worst part is, if you really solve the Schrodinger equation accurately, when you double the size of the system, the computer cost increases by 128, 2^7. So it doesn't matter if you have NASA's latest and greatest supercomputer, right? You'll have some size molecule that you can do, and people will be impressed. And then they'll say, oh, but can we do this one? And it's twice as big, right? And suddenly you need a computer that's more than 100 times bigger. So we've had this Moore's law running for, you know, 40 years, where the power of the computer goes up by a factor of 2 every 18 months or so, right? But even then, right, you have to wait a decade or so in order to do this kind of thing. So you always run out. And it turns out if you really want to solve the Schrodinger equation for a molecule, I will. Okay. I'm only warming up here. In this case, well, you can actually do various trade-offs, right? But it's basically the speed, right? So it will take 128 times longer, right? But given a certain piece of hardware, it'll take 128 times longer, and you will need a bigger machine as well, right? Okay, let's skip that. Okay, this is the great. Now, of course, you're actually going to get the greatest free lunch ever at lunchtime, right? That will be provided by the KITP staff. But if you want to solve these kind of problems, right? There was a bit of technology was created in the 60s by Homberg and Cohn, and then Cohn and Sham. And I don't know if you've noticed, right, the building where we are is called Cohn Hall. It's the same cone, right? Now, if he had only patented this, right, we could have been in a much nicer building, right? But he was actually so you should Google him. He's a very interesting guy, and he passed away 2 or 3 years ago. And he was a great theoretical physicist, one of the great theoretical physicists of the 20th century, and also a great sort of humanitarian. And his story is very, very interesting. But one of the things he did was he came up with this scheme where he said, given these problems, is there a way around them? And he made up a way around them that is very odd. I guess I'm going to skip some of the details. So in order to illustrate this idea, I'm going to use these. How many people know what this? Oh, fantastic, right? So I'm going to try to explain the idea, right, using one of them. So part of what I wanted to do, where's my Java? So this is, I've been using these in my classes for at least 10 years or so. So I still have one of the old Java applets, right? That's not HTML. So if the web goes down, it still works, right? So here we go. This is the power of simulation, right? It's great how you can really sort of bore your students with good simulation. Okay, so this is sort of boring. This is the Earth going around the sun, right? So now I'm going to add the moon, right? And so there it goes, and the moon is going around the Earth there. So the great thing about these simulations is you can speed them up or slow them down. I can put a grid on, right? And that's nice because, so many people use them, right? I mean, you can even give them quantitative problems once there's some way to measure things. In this case, we want to see the path, right? So we all learn, right, that you can think of the Earth as going around the sun and the moon going around the Earth, right? But until you see that kind of picture, right, you wouldn't really realize that means that the path of the moon there is a little sort of, right? It's just doing little circles around the Earth, but because the Earth is also moving, so I want to pause this, right? Now this is a classical problem, right? And it's just gravity. But so the different particles are interacting. This is the sun, the Earth, and the moon. And this is a very simple one, right? The moon really is just going around the Earth, and the Earth is just going around the sun. But see that even then it makes that very quite an interesting pattern in pink. So what Walter did was imagine the following. So this is a simple three-body problem, but imagine you're dealing with something like Jupiter, and you have, I've forgotten how many moons Jupiter has. Lots, yes, thank you. A very scientific term. Lots of moons, right? And imagine they're all the same size, right? Then you wouldn't, you really need a very complicated computer simulation to figure out what's going on. You can't separate it into a two-body problem, right? But, so if you just stare at this picture, and of course I wasn't able to remove this line, but just stare at the pink line there, right? You could imagine that the Earth not being there at all, and you wiggle the gravity of the sun just a little bit. You make a change in time. But you could find a force you could make up a fictitious force for the sun that would make the moon do exactly that pattern, right? If you knew that force, you wouldn't have to solve for the Earth's motion, right? Now this makes no sense, because to figure out that force, you obviously figure out that the Earth, right, where it is, and the Earth is right, and then that's simple. It's obvious. It seems much more complicated to think of this imaginary force just on the moon alone, right? That's because it's a classical problem. In quantum mechanics, right, the particles are smeared out into these probabilities of finding them. They're not at any one point with a definite velocity at any time. And if we can eliminate something like the Earth, or maybe there were many Earths and it's going in a crazy pattern, by a sort of average over the Earths, and you'll get an approximate pink line. But by doing this, you've switched it logically from this many-body problem to just one thing interacting with one other thing. And so the complexity of the equations that you have to solve are much, much simpler. And this is what, now this is like a totally weird thing to do, but they did this in 65. They imagined this. And it turns out then the last step is they then say, okay, well, here's an approximation. Try this approximation, and it works pretty good. How's my timing? I think I'm in desperate trouble. Yeah. Okay. So let's see what happens. Back here. So they do this. And this is a very obscure, it's not that obscure. Here we go. Yeah, we're back. Okay. So they do this, except I've lost the clicker. Maybe it'll work now. I'm sorry, I'm not taking any question. I'm kidding. Yes. Yeah. No. No.
Better. There. Much better. Yes. All right. In that model, so we have the pattern of the moon. You're saying wiggle the sun, and you can get that object.
Right.
Are you looking at it in two dimensions? Because the moon actually goes in a helix in its orbit. So when you're solving, are you solving for a flat? Or are you actually solving in three dimensions?
So in that simulation, it's flat.
Okay.
Right? So those simulations, I don't know if you've checked some of them out, right? They tend to simplify
craziness
a little
occurs.
Bit. Yeah, but good enough for teaching purposes, yes. But yes. Okay. So it turns out when you do this trick, right, you don't know that force, right, from that you would have to wiggle. So you make an approximation. But once you do that, then it turns out it's good enough for solid-state physics, but not accurate enough for chemistry. And then in the 90s, people made more accurate approximations, and this thing became very popular in chemistry and materials. So I want to get back to the machine learning part, right? So modern research to find this little piece of energy, right? I sometimes compare it to this, because so I said quantum mechanics was evil, right? But my sort of dear old friend Walter Cohen was also evil, because he proves, I mean, this is a real physics trick, right? He proves that this thing exists, but doesn't tell you anything about it, right? So we work on these formulas and try to get them more accurate, and the more accurate they are, the better the simulations are, right? So it's really important. But the most important thing is you can solve the equations of quantum mechanics much, much more cheaply. And yes, yeah, so I guess somebody was mentioning, right, this turned out, so there are various ways of measuring this, right? But one thing is, NVIDIA estimated that 1/6 of the world's supercomputers are devoted to solving electronic structure problems. 1/6. It is huge, right? There are very few scientific fields whose output is measured in thousands of papers per year, right? I used to make a joke that, I could look up some of these papers, and there was one in the European Journal of Soil Science. And it's like, so you can do these calculations on dirt and get them published, right? But somebody pointed out to me that this joke has come back to haunt me, because now I have a very brilliant postdoctoral fellow working with me who's trained in the Department of Geology. So now even in geology, they hire people to do these simulations. But I've gotten way off track. I know I've gotten way off track. So the applications, there are many. From catalysts to the Materials Genome Project, you may have heard of. People are doing all these DFT calculations. The world's hottest superconductor was predicted by these calculations and then made and found to have these properties. So this is a huge business. And the fact that your MacBook Air has lead-free chips in it is because of these sort of calculations. So here's Walter, right? Yes, he passed away in 2016. And see, he's grinning, right? Because he set this whole game in motion. He was also grinning because in 1998, he won the Nobel Prize in chemistry. Now, there's lots of theoretical physicists who've won Nobel Prizes in physics, but it takes a real genius to win it in a subject you know almost nothing about. I think there are only four cases of physicists winning Nobel Prizes in chemistry, and the sort of the top ranked one is Marie Curie, right? Rutherford. And of course, she won in both subjects, the only person. Okay, two problems in paradise. Problem number one is by using these fake electrons, so even though you've done this replacement, you still have to solve the equations. It still takes too long, and you can't run it like you'd run a regular molecular dynamics simulation. And then the other thing is that the most interesting exotic phenomena in quantum stuff, these sort of methods tend to fail. And in fact, that's how I first came to be working with Miles. We are very interested in what are called strongly correlated systems. So I'll give you one example. We go back to our H2, right? If I try to use my standard DFT calculations on H2, and I can tell how much energy it takes to break the bond. But I'm going to take the two hydrogens, And I'm going to sort of treat them, I'm going to isolate them as much as I can, and I'm going to separate them, and I'm going to take one to Mars, let's say, right? Now, you can prove that the two electrons that were in this combination are in what we call a spin singlet. Electrons have spin, and one of them is spin up, and one is spin down. But you don't know which one is which. And in fact, you can show that on each hydrogen atom, there's a 50% chance of a spin up and a 50% chance of a spin down. So you take that one to Mars, and I look at this one, and I measure the spin of the electron on this hydrogen atom. And either it's up or it's down. But the instant that I discover which one it is, I immediately know which one it is on Mars, that it's the other one on Mars. So this is one of the paradigm examples of, we now call this quantum entanglement. People have managed to do this with photons, not with electrons, over hundreds of miles these days. This was part of the reason why Einstein really didn't like quantum mechanics. This, they call it spooky, what do they call it? Spooky action, and thank you very much, right? How can that information have gotten from one side to the other instantly, but you can show that it doesn't really violate things. But this kind of calculation, you do a modern DFT calculation for this process, and it fails miserably because the quantum effects have gotten too strong. And it turns out it's really, really annoying. So I don't tell you this in the advertising. So in chemistry, and here's some more real chemistry, right? For most chemical systems, these quantum effects are not important. But when you get to arrangements of solids that have this great symmetry, because they're big lattices of things, they become much more important. And it turns out, really annoyingly, that a lot of the applications that the Department of Energy cares about, mostly in solar, sort of photovoltaics, all sorts of things, oxide materials are a little more strongly correlated than these are. And so these DFT methods sort of fail. So it would be really good if we could fix that, right? Which we will do, but possibly not before lunch. Okay. So one thing is in this machine learning revolution, right, we have big data in materials. So this is the Materials Genome Project. So everywhere around the world, people are generating massive databases of these DFT calculations because you want to design new materials, right, with certain functionalities. We're at this point where we can make all sorts of new materials, but our intuition fails, old guy's intuition sort of fails, because you can make so many different combinations. So you make a huge database and you use machine learning to try to find a material that has the properties that you want. And people are beginning to succeed at that. So how is my time? Here's kernel ridge regression. 10 minutes total, or
to talk and then there's and, time for questions.
Okay. Oh, great. Okay. So we're good. Okay. So kernel ridge regression. So you're going to hear throughout the rest of the day very fancy machine learning things, right? I'm going to show you some really simple machine learning things because they're the only things I know, right? Because I'm over the age of 40. Did I mention that? Okay, so kernel ridge regression. So I ran into this guy, a computer scientist at TU Berlin, a really nice guy, 5 or 6 or 7 years ago at a math institute, and he's a guru of this kind of machine learning. And so then we asked the question, could we use it to improve our density functionals? So you have some function, and you write, you want, so I'll it's better to show you. So this is looks so different from your sort of grandpa's theoretical physics, right? So you have, so here's a function of x, right? How many people also teach math? Right. So the other part of math, right, is statistics, right? So usually you either like the physics-y part of math or you like the statistics, but you don't necessarily like both, right? So this is all statistics. So I have some function here, I don't know what it is, and I have data. I've measured this function. But the data has noise, right? So it bounces around a bit. And this is all I have, right? So if I use this, so what we do is we approximate the function by a sum of Gaussians, and the Gaussians have some distance in them. So the more data I have, the more Gaussians I include. And how wide these Gaussians are is determined by one parameter, and then a second one we call the noise level determines how smooth my fit is to the data. If the noise level is very high, then it forces this function to be very smooth. And all I do then is minimize the error with the noise included. So when I do that here, and I give it a high noise level, it produces a function that's very smooth, all right, but it doesn't model the underlying function very well. If I decrease the noise level, I get a reasonable looking fit. And if I decrease it too much, the thing fits all the data, and that's what we call overfitting, right? And we know that what you're doing is just fitting particular data. And then if I give you a new data point, it'll be pretty bad because it's just fitting that noise. So then we have these tricks like cross-validation. So you have 100 data points. You remove 20 from your data set, which you're going to go back to test, and then you train your thing, and then you minimize your error on the remaining 20, so that's leaving out 20, and then you do it again and again, and you get the best fit of these parameters, and you average them. So this is like a trick, a bootstrap trick, to try to get the best parameters, and when you do that, it turns out the best value is 0.46, and so there's your fit at 0.46, and there's the original function. And you see it does this balancing act between fitting the function and not overfitting, not underfitting. So it figures out how to do that. So we apply this to try to find functionals.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
It might be a very naive question, but so when we just make measurements, how do we know that the measurements are even noisy? So,
yes.
I don't know if I. So you made a set of measurements, and why do we know that those measurements have noise?
So this is like some of the really difficult. This is like one of the very difficult questions in this field, right? So, if you're a physicist, right, and you sort of look at this thing, right, you have what we call prior knowledge. You have a sense of what the problem is that you're solving. I mean, you sort of look at this and you see, right, oh, this is the noisy stuff and there's some underlying signal, right? But if you're looking at, people's choices for the Netflix movie, right, then those rules don't apply. So how you figure out which is a very hard question, yeah.
We are assuming some framework to start with.
So I mentioned very quickly, right, this. So the rise of this field has come about, it's this Bayesian point of view, right, where you have some sort of unknown distribution behind the data, and you make assumptions about what it looks like. You have to make some assumptions. Now, the reason this has taken off, in my opinion, over the last 10 years or so, is the vast computational power we now have. So Bayesian type theories you can actually do some decent calculations on, and that's why we now have these things. And now we have, like, you'll hear about half a dozen different algorithms, and people are trying to understand why they work with exactly these kinds of questions, right?
That function is then at the end a sum of many Gaussians.
The fitted one is the sum of many Gaussians. This one is something I made up, right? Cosine squeezed or something, plus some noise, right? We did this a while ago, right? But an interesting thing is, one of the uses of these techniques now is, say you don't have enough data, you generate fake data that's like the data you think you want to look at. And then you train your algorithms on the fake data, and then they work on the real data, right? As long as your fake data isn't too different from the real data, right? So there's all these circular kind of things, and there, I think they'll come up throughout the day. Yes, Heather?
My question I have is that this assumption, you have an ingrained bias that is there. Because you're saying that we assume from our prior knowledge.
And yes.
Prior knowledge may will have bias that you will continue on seeing things that you may miss a lot because of that.
And if I were an expert in this field, I might be able to give you a good answer, right? But I'm sure these young people that we're going to hear from will be able to do that. So I want to try to get to the sort of where I wanted to go with some of this, right? Let me see if I can do it. Okay, so... we'll see. Okay, so this is my first ever movie. Now, it's not a very exciting movie, but I'm going to show it to you anyway, right? It did make a bit of a splash, right? So this is with a collaboration of chemists and computer scientists, right? So this is malonaldehyde, and what we do is, I got to pause this. Can I pause it? You can see how good I really am with computers. So this is malonaldehyde. And what we're going to see, so what we do is we take a DFT calculation and we run it. We actually heat it up more than room temperature because what we want it to do is wiggle around and it explores many different configurations of the nuclei, different geometries and things like that. And we say double the temperature, so it explores this space. We run this DFT calculation, which is too expensive to run for too long, right? But what we do is we then take snapshots of the molecule at different, contortions, and we learn the density functional. We do exactly that kernel ridge trick to learn the density functional for those distortions. And we do about 1,000 of these. And then the machine has learned what the density functional is that avoids solving Walter's equations. So then when you run the machine thing, it runs like at least thousands of times faster. In fact, so fast we don't even measure it. It runs much, much faster than solving the equations of quantum mechanics. So what has happened is, even though it's a really hard quantum many-body problem, right? We know that the whole thing is represented just by a few electrons and a few different atoms, right? That's very simple. So what we're learning is the pattern in the solution to those equations. We're not solving the equations anymore. There's an underlying pattern. Which we're not good enough to see, but the machine learned thing does see. So anyway, so we do that, and then we actually figure out the forces on these things, and we can run a molecular dynamics simulation. But the amazing thing was that when we did that for the first time, see the hydrogen atom between the two oxygens, right, is going to do something very dramatic. It jumps from one to the other. So it's a proton transfer from one to the other. But the reason that's so very exciting is it wasn't in the test set. In the ones that we did, there was no proton transfer. So then, having trained the thing without that, we then see it, which it does happen in nature, in the simulation. Now, this is like a little molecule, and nobody cares, right? But it's a proof of principle that you can learn the stuff in one case and then extrapolate. Now, it turns out, in fact, there's a little quantum tunneling that goes on, so that isn't quite accurate, but that's for the experts to argue about. One last quick thing is facial recognition, right? So I had this very good student, Lee Lee, a physics student, and I was trying to explain what something called principal component analysis is. So we decided to test it on facial recognition, and yes, that is my face, right? So I had to, I did it one night because I was giving the talk the next day, and at the conference on my Mac, I took 16 pictures, right? And in fact, there's a little technical thing where the average position of my head has to be exactly the same in every photo. So that's part of the grimacing, right? Okay, so then he processes it overnight and then comes back to me the next morning, right? So this is my mean face. If I'm in a really bad mood going down the corridor, this is what I look like. No, so this is the average of all these images, right? So then we do what's called a principal component analysis. You ask, in what direction is the data most changing? And when you include the direction which is most changing, and add how much there is in this particular picture, it gets a little bit better. And then when we add 7 of these components, you get this, which was this picture here, which isn't quite the same, but I'm still, why did he pick that one? Anyway, the point is you only need 7 coefficients, 7 numbers to produce this thing here, right? And think of the amount of data that's in these 16 images, right? And so he was working on this problem of strong correlation, and he was a really excellent student, and now he works at Google Accelerated Science. And what he did was he applied that principle to the atoms in a molecule. Chemists have very clever ways of taking the density of a molecule and writing it as a sum of the atoms. So he did principal component analysis that they use for facial recognition to recognize the densities of the atoms in the molecule, and it turned out to be the key thing that made it possible to do the calculation. Okay, we'll skip that. Okay, the very last thing, almost, is, this is a paper I'm very proud of from about 20 years ago. So this Physical Review Letters is the leading physics journal in the world, pretty much, right? And I was working on a time-dependent version of the thing at the time. I was a young assistant professor at Rutgers Camden in New Jersey. Anybody know where Camden is? Good, yeah. And I don't know if you know, it's a bit of a, certainly 20 years ago, it was a bit of a tough area, right? So this guy here, Paul Hessler, right? This is the top journal in physics in the world. This was the group at the time, and this is Paul here. Let's see. Yes, this was the best photo I could find of him. So he was a high school teacher in Woodrow Wilson High. And Woodrow Wilson High, I bet, is a tougher school maybe than any of you guys teaching, right? 1/3 of the annual operating budget of the school vanished every year. This is Jersey, right? I once walked over to the school to give a presentation to the high school kids, and every third house was boarded up by the DEA, right? It was a very rough neighborhood. Anyway, so Paul was a high school teacher. He had been a programmer, and he'd given up and he was a very good one, and he gave up his high-paying job in order to teach in the inner city, right? And he got what he asked for. And it was the stuff that would go on would just break your heart as to with some of these kids. There was this program run by the American Chemical Society, where you could take a high school teacher and you do some research for the summer. And so I took on Paul, and he was really, I mean, just fantastic. And we were able to publish this FizRev letter from the research that he did. Now, later, the grant came up for renewal, and I sent in a renewal request from the Research Corporation. And this letter is a very famous letter that came back. In which the president of the Research Corporation has personally written this letter in response. The two of you break all the rules, right? Paul was supposed to be a chemistry teacher, and he wasn't, right? And he actually got a degree in physics afterwards. He wasn't supposed to be a he was a math teacher at the time. We're supposed to do real chemical stuff, right? That was written into the grant. We didn't do that.